Centre at 6. An area in Manchester has been evacuated after police found a car which they say may be significant to the terror attack investigation. Officers are asking for help in tracking the movements of a white Nissan Micra. Earlier, Prince William met people in the city who responded to the atrocity. Hasib Khan helped to deliver food and water the day after. He says it was a great honour to meet the Duke.
He asked us mainly how we were involved and what we did, and he was really thankful and he said we reflected the community spirit really well, and he specifically mentioned the words that, you know, you're a shining light for the youth of Manchester.
Meanwhile, Ticketmaster's asking fans to be patient as it continues to work through applications for the One Love Manchester concert. Those at the Ariana Grande gig that was targeted could register for free passes to this Sunday's event, but some say they haven't heard back from the firm yet. Tory candidate Craig McKinley insists he's done nothing wrong after being charged following an investigation into spending at the 2015 general election. He's standing to be re-elected in South Thanet and says he's shocked at the decision. Arnold Schwarzenegger is criticising Donald Trump for pulling out of the Paris climate deal.
One man can't stop our clean energy revolution, and one man can't go back in time. Only I can do that. My message to you, Mr. President, is that as a public servant, especially as a president, your first and most important responsibility is to protect the people.
The actor passed the strictest environmental laws in the US when he was California governor. He's urged Mr. Trump to choose the future rather than backing fossil fuels. British Airways cabin crew are to stage a four-day strike later this month. Members of the Unite Union will walk out from June the 16th in a long-running row over pay. And police are warning football fans not to buy tickets for the Champions League final on the street as they could be stolen. Real Madrid take on Juventus in Cardiff tomorrow. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
And a lot of the information that you're going to hear on this program comes from the efforts of hundreds, sometimes thousands, of unsung heroes who prefer to remain in the background, who are constantly gathering and sending information to our central clearinghouse, where we are in the process of assembling two puzzles. One is the deception, what they want us to believe, and the other is the truth. The truth is what we need to know to survive. Seek ye the truth, and the truth shall set you free, folks, and nothing else in this world will do it. Nothing.
Back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The Bilderbergs, with as much unelected money and power as they have in election week, why should they give a damn about what we think? Yes, the West's kingmakers are huddled together again with Kissinger and other serial war criminals until Sunday. They're holed up in the Westfields Marriott Hotel, Chantilly, Virginia, just a stone's throw from the White House and the National Reconnaissance Office over in the USA. Although those that run our media are there, will they be reporting what goes on? Yes, it's the good old annual Bilderberg meeting, where the richest and most powerful people we don't elect in the West get together in secret once a year. With some educated guesswork, we're going to try and deduce what they won't tell us. Plus, why won't MI5 tell us what they know? How many times do they meet the Manchester bomber, Salman Abedi, and National Security? Again, only it wasn't, was it, National Security? We hear from a former Army and Special Branch officer all about what he makes of MI5's role in the Manchester attack. Plus, 50 years since the beginning of the end of the UN Charter. That's only 20 years after it had actually been agreed. And while Britain was hopping away to the Beatles, Israel was allowed to grab thousands of square miles of Syria, Jordan and Egypt in the 1967 Six-Day War, in a theft of territory which is running sore to this day. In a fascinating incident, the secret Israeli attempt to sink the USS Liberty ship, which the US Navy under President Lyndon Johnson incredibly ignored. Our sister show Dialect is here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, an election special. We hear the concerns of Laura Welty from the Bristol Disability and Equality Forum, also from Miscarriage of Justice campaigner Sabine McNeil, as well as another clip from the interview the mainstream media won't play with a former US Special Forces soldier, James Files, recruited by the Chicago Mafia, who says he carried out the assassination of US President JFK in 1963. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect. And if you can't wait, download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, I'm joined on the line from Chantilly, Virginia, by journalist Charlie Skelton. Hi, Charlie, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Okay.
The Bilderbergers all started to arrive yesterday, I believe.
That's right. Yes, so they're here now, and by and large, the limousines have rolled up, and they're settling down now to a day of discussion and lobbying and that kind of thing. So yes, it's all underway.
So look, a little bird tells me there's less. There's actually quite a lot of less press, bloggers, and campaigners on the outside doing campaigning this year than there were the last time Bilderberg was in the US back in 2012.
Well, there's less press outside than there are inside. That's in terms of mainstream
Amazing.
Media. There's quite a lot of press, actually, at the inside the conference this year. Outside is it's a slightly poor showing, I have to say, from the mainstream. I've got my thoughts on why that is. But yes, it's a bit disappointing.
So why? Yeah, why?
Well, I think it's... You know, I think perhaps it's rather than being anything too sinister, I think it's the Bilderberg group just sort of keeping very, very tight-lipped, and the mainstream media being so addicted to PR releases and press releases and notifications from people about events that they want covering, that if they don't have a press release land on their desk, they sort of don't think the event exists. It just doesn't happen. So they haven't turned up because... You know, I think they're very used to being spoon-fed, and I think Bilderberg is holding back the spoon.
Well, what you're suggesting is that they're not proactive, the mainstream press. They're just reacting. In fact, in a way, just spooning out to us, if you're talking about spoons, what the big corporate press releases are spooning to them, you know?
Well, absolutely. And I went to the G7 meeting a couple of years ago now in Germany, and... I've never seen anything like it in terms of spoon feeding. Being a journalist there was an extraordinary experience. You've got, you got hot desk around. You've got your memory sticks with footage on. You've got information packs. You've got free meals, free booze. It was an extraordinary thing, and that was because you were being given exactly what the PR machine of the G7 wanted. Put out there.
So no Roger Cooks and no investigative journalists in there. Anyway, look, there is a core of people at Bilderberg, that is a steering committee, that choose the guests every year. But of course, there's about 120 altogether. Who stands out on the list for you this year?
Well, it's interesting to see George Osborne here. He's taken time out from editing the Evening Standard in an election week to come across here, which I thought was a bold move, but he knows which side his bread is buttered. But also, I mean, I have to say the director of CERN stands out a little bit.
Now, this is this particle accelerator type thing, isn't it? Down on the Swiss-French border, I think. So why might somebody from a particle accelerator be at Bilderberg?
Well, I honestly don't know whether or not it's... it may be just that they've organised a kind of high-level TED talk just to amuse... themselves between kind of geopolitical machinations, but or maybe maybe they're more interested in something else that's going on at CERN. I have no idea, but anyway, she does stand out.
What about others that jump out at you from the list?
I guess the most significant name was the US ambassador to China is here. So that's a remarkable name, really, to have someone that's actually properly representing the Chinese government at a high level here at this political summit. You can see kind of, Kissinger's long been you know, pivoted towards China.
But hang on, and, it's not a political summit. It's a private meeting. They say that again and again in all their releases. This is a private meeting.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, that really isn't the case in the sense that, well, it's private in the sense of extremely secluded and hidden away from the press. But the politicians who go in their professional, in their political capacity, and also take staff, members of staff. We've seen many times members of various ministries turn up with their ministers. So yeah, this is it's an official bit of government business for the governments who are here.
Look, I mean, I call them the kingmakers at the top of the hour. I just want to run through some of the people who've been to Bilderberg Conference and then miraculously found, it's like the magic wand of power, you know, found themselves in either presidents or prime ministers of countries. We've had Barack Obama, he participated in 2008 and then he became US president. Gerhard Schröder and Angela Merkel attended in 2005 after the vote of confidence in Schröder and a new German Chancellor Merkel appeared. Jean-Claude Trichet, he went to Bilderberg in 2003, then he became President of the European Central Bank straight after that. José Manuel Barroso, he went in 2003, then he became President of the European Commission straight after that. Jürgen Schremp, he went to Bilderberg in 1994 and was made head of Daimler Benz, Mercedes. Then Tony Blair went in 1993 and he then became Labour Party leader and British Prime Minister. Bill Clinton went in 1991 and he got the Democratic nomination and became US President afterwards. Helmut Kohl went in 1982, then became German Chancellor. Margaret Thatcher, if we go back that far, went to Bilderberg in 1977, then afterwards became British Prime Minister 2 years later. Helmut Schmidt went in 1973, then became Federal Chancellor. Now, that doesn't even mention all of the NATO Secretaries General since the 1960s have been to Bilderberg meetings before they've then been made Secretary General. So this kingmaker, it surprises me that not more press are interested in who the next kings, prime ministers and presidents are going to be, Charlie.
Well, I think the most interesting thing that's happened recently is France. I mean, if you look at the where Macron has come from, he's the political organization that brought him to power was, he went to Bilderberg, so is his prime minister, Edouard Philippe. And the organization that Macron took into power was registered at the Institut Montaigne. And when it came into being, and that's the president of that is the president of Bilderberg, Henri de Castries. So you can certainly do an analysis of the recent French election and say that Bilderberg have kind of licked their Brexit wounds and come back, with a vengeance.
Okay. So, do any Bilderbergers, when you get close to them, actually want to talk to you?
Well, that's a question that could certainly be answered better by the gentleman sitting to my right-hand side here.
Luke Radowski. Hi, Luke.
Hey, Tony, how are you?
Oh, great. I know you've been trying to get some of these people on the record as they've been arriving at the airport. Very nifty stuff, because, once they get into their transport to the Bilderberg conference, they're then completely locked away. But you were at the airport, and you did rather well in collaring some. Can you tell, did any of them actually want to talk to you?
It's incredibly nifty to see the face of the Bilderbergers when you're able to walk up to them. And we had a different strategy than we did other years. My strategy was to walk up to them, introduce myself. I gave them a compliment, whether it was their suitcase or their scarf or their hair or their shoes. And then automatically they got a very big smile. And then directly pointing them to the question, "What are you doing at Bilderberg?" That smile somehow magically just turned into a frown very fast. And this happened. There's about 20 Bilderberg members that I talked to yesterday. Some of them like to change the subject to the weather. And they were talking about how lovely of weather it is down here in Chantilly, Virginia. And it is lovely. But they kind of did obscure the fact of what they're doing here at the Bilderberg meeting. A lot of them, the majority of them, gave us the silent treatment or the usual surprising no comment. Other ones did talk a little bit, and we're going to be releasing those videos. I'm going to release a video of it's going to be called the Bilderberg Walk of Shame, no comment, hallway. And I'm going to release the video of about 15 of them who completely just ignored us like we weren't even human beings in their existence. And then I'm going to release another video where Bilderberg speak out and give you some of the commentary, which I found interesting. But yet again, it was very, very generalized. And sometimes, majority of the times, they were just talking to talk and not giving us anything of substance.
Now, look, can I just try and grab a little trailer for that video from you? Did any of them say anything that made much sense, enlightened you at all as to what they're discussing in there? Since these people are those that decide on our fate, to a large extent, they are picking people who then go on to lead our countries. And we're told we've got a general election here in Britain next week, but it looks like these guys actually play a bigger part in some ways in deciding who's in charge of our countries.
Well, one of their own members previously even stated before, this is where the consensus for world major events are made. You know, some of these Bilderberg members brag about how they were creators of the euro. There's even New York Times articles talking about how John Edwards' speech at the Bilderberg meeting has prompted him to be selected to be the vice president candidate of John Kerry in the 2004 presidential elections here in the United States. So obviously there is some influence, and for them and other establishment mainstream media types to say that this has no influence at all is really just kind of a disrespect to our intelligence, because obviously it's very important and it's very significant. I remember talking to one Bilderberger. We were trying to see if what was all the kind of hearsay about the Trump administration. It seems like there's a lot of speculation whether the Bilderberg group is for or against Trump, so we were trying to gauge some of that yesterday, and really nothing of significance. We got one Bilderberg member saying that he was against the Paris Agreement and against Trump for going against the Paris Agreement, which was interesting. There's been so much, though. It's just I'm just going to release all the videos on youtube.com/WeAreChange today and tomorrow, just to give people the full perspective and the full context of everything that was said on the record. And, okay, of course, the lovely the lovely no comments that we've gotten from our reporting as well, which, yep, sometimes speaks louder than words.
It does. So they actually barge straight past you, or just kind of walk around you, Luke?
Oh, it was fascinating. I mean, automatically when I arrived at the airport, we went to the private jet terminal. And as soon as I arrived there, before taking any pictures and videos, I just walked up to security guards with my press credentials, showed them my press credentials, and told them what I'm here to do. And they contested. They said it was fine if I stand in this one area, and I did. And then all of a sudden, I'm surrounded by airport officials and police officers with about five cars who came there. And supposedly the security, which was associated with Bilderberg security, told the police that we were very suspicious and disorderly. The police came on the site to talk to us, said, I don't know why those guys said that. You guys are clearly not disorderly and suspicious. I'm going to put in a dispatch to let everyone know that you guys are fine no matter what happens, and if you get stopped again, they'll know that I talked to you and that I checked you guys out and everything was great. The security officials had us contact the PR person. We contacted the PR person, got permission, and as soon as we were granted permission, we were good to go, and we decided to just go with it as much as we can. Every time we saw a Bilderberg member, 20 plus of them, we just went right up to them and started talking to them. We got detained a number of times, though, continually throughout the day, but every time we did, it was funny. We saw some of the security guards associated with the Bilderberg group run up to Homeland Security, run up to the TSA, run up to the, I think, two different police departments, and keep trying to get us in trouble. And then again, we were momentarily detained. They called through dispatch. I told them we got permission, and then they let us go. Some of the Bilderberg members, like Larry Summers, which I just released a video with now, weren't happy at all. You could just see the begrudgement, the frustration and anger on his face with the full video that I just released on, again, cheap plug, but this video is important to see, youtube.com/WeAreChange.
So do you think Trump maybe put a call into the local police department for you?
Trump? I don't think it was Trump. But it was a very respectful police officer who understood the situation. And here in the United States, we have freedom of the press. Unlike Germany last year, where I was pretty much grabbed up by German police officers and threatened with physical violence and false arrest if I didn't skip town and leave town and stop reporting on the Bilderberg Group. So it's a lot different here in the United States, and I think they the police officers have conducted themselves very fairly, at least from you know, my experiences here at
Bilderberg. Hang on, Luke, because you say in the US you've got freedom of the press, but you've got quite a lot of your senior press people in there. They're saying nothing about the conference and hardly any reporting on the outside of the conference. So that's not really a free press, is it?
Yeah, well, it depends on
the free press is free not to report. Look, I'll tell you what, I'll bring my old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers in here. Martin, what do you make of these Bilderberg meetings?
Well, they're obviously of great influence, and they've been very important in Western politics for many years. If you remember when they came to Watford in 2014, was it, or 2013, I made a speech to it. We had quite a crowd, didn't we, that year for people who were interested in what they were up to. And at that time, Fernando Imposimato, who was the... who was the head of the Italian Supreme Court, who's written a book, La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, which was about the Gladio terrorism in Italy in the 1970s and the role of the secret services. And, of course, he is actually the head of the Italian Supreme Court. He was the investigating magistrate on many of these events, such as the Bologna bombing, the kidnapping and assassination of Aldo Moro, the Prime Minister, and he was actually, I think, involved in Piazza Fontana, the first bombing and the years of lead the Annie Di Piombo in 1969. But anyway, just before the Bilderbergers had arrived, he'd actually given an interview to Corriere della Sera in Italy, saying that as far as he was concerned, the Bilderbergers were the source of terrorism in Italy in the 1970s. This is the head of the Italian Supreme Court. So they're not at all just a little discussion group talking about how to make a better widget.
I hope we've got Luke and Charlie back now. Now look, maybe this is for you first, Luke. Several of Trump's closest advisers are in the Bilderberg conference, but not necessarily his closest friends, are they?
Well, it's a mix. It's very interesting. I was just in the car hearing Larry Summers talking about his disappointment with Trump and how Trump won't be the president forever when he was talking about the Paris Agreement. And then we have also very close allies to Trump, like Peter Thiel, Henry Kissinger, his close aides and associates and cabinet members like H.R. McMaster, who have decisively called very terrible foreign policy decisions with the United States. I mean, we know Bilderberg's focus is mainly a European-U.S. kind of alliance, and many of the members throughout its history and throughout its agenda have been very adversarial towards Russia. H.R. McMaster is very adversarial towards Russia. It was the main policy shift when Donald Trump got rid of Michael Flynn and replaced him with the now National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster, who's now at this Bilderberg meeting. So there's this kind of speculation going on online whether Bilderberg is working with Trump or trying to get rid of Trump. And there's going to be very important discussions happening down there. I can't make up my mind, and I'm not one to speculate. I don't like the conspiracy theories. There was one news outlet, a major independent one, that confirmed with anonymous sources that it was to get rid of Trump. But in these types of situations, we can't verify any of that. We don't know for sure any of that. And I can't really trust a news outlet who has unnamed sources with their reporting that goes directly towards their agenda that they have been pushing individually themselves as a news organization. So when things like that happen, it makes you really wonder what will take place. Okay. Obviously, we don't know. I am under the impression that Trump would be more in line to colluding with them, especially with his foreign policy stances against Russia, his very strong moves inside of the Middle East against the Syrian government, and very strong alliance with Saudi Arabia, which plays in line with the overall kind of dichotomy that Bilderberg has set up and pushed for throughout the years. So my impression of it is that Trump and his close associates are more colluding together rather than Bilderberg going against Donald Trump.
Okay, Charlie, are you there still?
Yeah, Charlie, the war on information, one of the headlines on the topic for discussion. It's the first time I've heard it called the war on information. I thought it was supposed to be called fake news. But there are a lot of analysts around the world that say that 80% of modern warfare is actually propaganda. It's information warfare. And we've got in the conference, I noticed on the list, is the head of Ofcom, or the boss of our broadcasting regulator. Why would a broadcasting regulator be sitting in with these Bilderbergs? I mean, one of the things they've done, for example, is Ofcom banned the Iranian broadcasting in the UK, and there's been several close shaves with the Russian broadcasters, RT. So I wonder whether, you know, there may be pressure being put on Ofcom to get RT banned. I mean, we know there's a lot of people in the US that really despise it. They see it just as a Russian propaganda service, maybe as the Russians might see the BBC as a British propaganda service. So what's the significance of having Ofcom in the middle of, amongst all these bankers and politicians?
Oh yeah, just it's very interesting to see that war information in terms of Russia, because you've also got on the agenda Russia in the international order. So it's, you know, Russia is definitely front and center in Bilderberg's mind. And, you know, you do have lots of the intelligence community there, a real lot of you know, people from Homeland Security, former CIA heads, you know, former deputies of the CIA, that kind of thing there. So there's a very strong intelligence community represented this year. So, yeah, I think propaganda and Russia and, you know, trying to win a war on information is definitely part of their game.
Now, yesterday Vladimir Putin gave a speech over in St. Petersburg to all the heads of the wire services, foreign wire services, Martin Summers, didn't he? Saying something about, effectively, that there are stories of this being made up again and again, that there's Russophobia, and the object is to support the West's policies in Syria.
Well, it was a very wide-ranging speech which he made yesterday, which I commented on RT after he'd finished. The Russians are basically speaking calmly, but they're not very happy about what's going on at all. They feel really threatened by missiles being put into Poland, Romania, and now in South Korea. They are basically threatening that if we carry on down this road, we're going to end up with perhaps have a nuclear war by accident. And Putin is trying, and I think the Russians are trying, to talk sensibly to the Western powers, but there's an absolute hysteria in the West. I mean, all this stuff about how the Russians are fixing Western elections. I mean, the Russians just think this is ludicrous. And, of course, Trump is hardly their puppet since he's been attacking the Syrian army with great gusto. And of course, Macron has been complaining that he nearly lost the election because the Russians were hacking the French election. So you got 60% of the vote. What are you on about? And the Russians just feel that the West has just lost the plot when it comes to things like this.
Charlie, what do you make of the sort of discussions that might be going on in there about this so-called war on information?
Well, I mean, it strikes me as it leaves a rather sort of sour taste in my mouth when you think of, you know, the things that Luke and Dan have been through here and that I, even, you know, my small way of being through in terms of a war on information. This is an organization that detests the spread of information. You know, they spend millions and millions of pounds trying to stop the press talking to them and sharing information with the public. So, you know, I find it a little bit rich that that they're sitting around discussing, you know, oh, how can we get the truth out there, when they spend so much time trying to stop the truth getting out there and actually spreading disinformation about their own activities and the nature of their meeting.
So in what way are they lying about or spreading disinformation about what they do?
Well, I mean, a very good example is what we began with earlier, which is they said for years and years that people went there in their own private capacity as individuals and not as representatives of their office. But I remember being in St. Moritz when George Osborne was on the list when he was Chancellor, and ringing the Treasury, and eventually after about a day being on the phone with them, they said, yes, he's there. He's there with ministerial staff, and he's there as the Chancellor of the Exchequer. And they've stopped, they've dropped that now. And there's a number of examples of other things where they've sort of been forced by pressure, mainly from the alternative media, to kind of stop fudging the truth. But anyway, it's good to know that they're, you know, they're engaged in the the battle for truth there in Chantilly.
Well, last year it was Brexit, just after Bilderberg in Dresden. This year it's a UK general election, and the tide is turning really fast against the Conservatives, starting off with a 20-25% lead over Labour. We're now, the latest poll is saying there's going to be a hung parliament, Charlie. I wonder, would that suit the Bilderbergs? Because they were certainly one of the people who were behind the European Union in the first place, things like the single currency, this kind of thing. And I wonder if this turn, do you think there'll be smiles at Bilderberg, seeing that things are turning against a hard Brexit in Britain?
Well, anything which could, you know, they were, don't forget, they were Bilderberg steering committee members just before the Brexit vote, out there, you know, on their soapboxes, in making speeches and doing photo opportunities, anything to make sure there would be a Remain victory. So, you know, it's a big deal for them. You know, you look at what the agenda this year, and they're trying to reform the, you know, Europe. They're saying, you know, the direction of the EU, that's one of the agenda items. So that absolutely they would be delighted to see a shift in Britain away from Brexit. I remember I once spoke to the former Secretary General of the European Commission, and was told, I asked, well, what would happen if Greece left? And they said, well, not, doesn't really matter. And then I said, what about Britain? And they went, well, that would be catastrophic. So, I mean, I think that, you know, in terms of, it's a big deal. Obviously, it's a huge, enormous deal for Britain to come away, to pull away from the EU. So, yeah, they would be absolutely delighted if a more Europhilic flavour to British politics was to, you know, come back into power.
Now, my experience last year, talking to some of the Bilderbergers, Jacob Wallenberg and James A. Johnson, particularly confronting them, really, asking them politely about Brexit, was that they just simply don't have anybody in the room with them that doesn't agree with them, that these are sort of people who are effectively invulnerable to any kind of criticism. They're so rich and powerful. That's one of the things that I've learned over the years about the Bilderbergers, is that there's a kind of groupthink there, that they're all on the same page, and unless you're on the same page or close to being on the same page, you're not going to get invited. I wonder where you think that's ultimately heading with this group.
Well, I mean, just to say about the nature of groupthink, I think that is actually probably the most important way you could describe Bilderberg, is it's about consensus. It's about forming consensus and steering consensus. They talk about all kinds of different subjects, you know, China, Russia, the EU, but all the time they're trying to get everyone on the same page. That's what, you know, that's, for me, even more than the king-making, that for me is what it's about. It's about consensus.
Yeah, and where is that consensus going? If you look at the policy around the table with Henry Kissinger and various people vying to be sitting next to him at supper, where are these people heading? Where's their vision for the future? What is it?
Well, absolutely no idea, but with the head of CERN there, maybe their vision is simply to turn the universe off. I don't know.
Turn it upside down. Okay, is Luke still there, Charlie?
He is, yes.
Yeah, can I have a quick final word with Luke?
Yep, I'm right here.
Yeah, Luke, what is it that brings you halfway around the world to look at a Bilderberg meeting year after year?
To do the job that the mainstream media is not doing, and to put them to shame by really informing the public about the most important or an event that I think everyone should know about and understand. Really, to me, the media aspect of this is the most fascinating. This is something incredibly interesting. You don't even have to go down the conspiratorial route. The fact that these people are just meeting is fascinating. The fact that these people come here once a year and they spend public taxpayers' money, that they're able to get away with doing that, that they're able to set up such a massive security operation. And this is supposed to be nothing? This is something that, you know, decades ago the media would say didn't even exist. And I think it's very important for alternative media, independent media, to be the eyes and ears of the people, to show people what's happening, to ask questions that a lot of these establishment types don't want to be asked. You know, that is our primary role and function, to be a service to the people. And that's what makes me out here. Our organization is sustained by people's donations, and it's just an honor and pleasure being able to do real, honest work on the ground, pounding the pavement, being out there for hours. It's not a job that's easy, especially with all The security apparatuses that we have to go through and the harassment and intimidation we have to go through some years. But it's a job that I find very worthwhile, that I find very important.
Well, I'll put a link on our show page to Charlie's articles. I think, is it International Business Times? Charlie's been writing for, and The Guardian. And also to your pages, Luke, on YouTube and elsewhere. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show from Chantilly, Virginia.
Thank you. Thank you.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Martin, this is a serious business, isn't it? We're just about to have a general election here in the UK, and yet there's a whole bunch of people rich, mostly Goldman Sachs. As Charlie said in one of his articles, there's a bit of a smell of squid coming across from the Bilderberg conference. They're all there.
Well, I mean, as you know, they have one every year anyway, whether we're having a general election or not. So they will no doubt be discussing the implications of the general election.
Well, my point really here is that these bankers have an ability to fund whichever groups that they want to succeed, whether that be political parties or media corporations.
Well, it does. I mean, obviously, we don't know all the detail of the things that they discuss. I mean, as you know, in the distant past, we didn't know they'd used to deny that they existed, which is extraordinary, really, if you think about it.
At the top of the agenda is the Trump administration, a progress report. It doesn't seem that Bilderberg are very happy with Trump.
Well, I imagine, yes, I can imagine that they, if I was Bilderberg, I wouldn't be that disappointed with Trump. He's pretty much going to do what they want. There's not much reason for them to dislike him. He's caved in over Russia. But on the other hand, some people are so hostile to him that they just think, well, we're going to get rid of him and replace him with Pence, who's the vice president, who's even more to the liking of the Bilderbergers. But no doubt the discussion of whether Trump is to be defenestrated or not is probably going to be one of the most important things that they'll be talking about.
Another thing on the agenda is the Transatlantic Defence Alliance, bullets, bites and bucks. So I guess they're talking about NATO there. NATO is centre stage, isn't it? Because it's almost always exactly the NATO countries that everyone gets invited from. The fact that the Chinese are there, it's very occasional the Chinese are there. But that, again, suggests NATO, doesn't it? It suggests the Chinese are being brought into NATO as in a way to get around
That's Kissinger's strategy to try and isolate Russia. But I think what will happen with the Chinese ambassador is he'll just sit there smiling and saying nothing.
Inscrutably.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it's nice to be invited, but he's not going to be drawn into making any deals with anybody. He hasn't got the authority.
But I mean, surely it's about relationships as well. I mean, we were hearing from Charlie, you've got various people who, I mean, for example, George Osborne, he comes as Chancellor, he changes his job to editor of the Evening Standard, he comes as editor of the Evening Standard.
Well, he's actually supposed to be an MP, if we need to be reminded of that.
But there are no MPs right now.
I think he's standing again in his Tatton constituency.
I think he's standing down, isn't he? But anyway, I may be wrong about that. But the point here being, it's about individuals, and they change their hats from time to time. They change their hats again, and Marcus Agius is there. He was an executive board of the BBC until fairly recently. Mm-hmm. Then he went to Barclays, and at each job it's a new title for him, but it's the same person coming to the conferences. There's also John Saws. He's down as one of the partners at Macro Partners, in big investment firm, obviously doing quite a lot of military work, but that actually his real big job was as Director General of MI6. So a lot of these people go to these conferences, they're chatting and schmoozing with these people in other contexts too, not just Bilderberg, but it's about the person, it's not necessarily about the job. And as they change jobs, they still come to these conferences.
Well, that's not the ruling class networking.
Yes, it sounds a bit like it's a kind of little club. You're either in or out.
Well, of course it is. I mean, the ruling class has always done this. This is how ruling classes operate. And in many ways, you see, we can't argue if the wealthy ruling class have a private meeting where they get together and try and cook things up. What is pernicious and very clearly pernicious about Bilderberg is the role of political representatives who are supposed to represent the public. Now, if somebody's going to go as a political representative to this meeting, I want a report back and I want to see some minutes. This is the real issue. Presumably, they could have private meetings, which we knew nothing about, with just the business types there. But that's not the point, is it? They want the political types and the heads of intelligence services. These people are public employees. And, there's a serious question mark about what they're doing there. And if they're going to go there, then we want to hear from them what they've been talking about.
One Nation, One World on Bristol's BCFM 93.2. Inclusive radio for Bristol.
Well, why won't MI5 tell us what they knew? How many times they met the Manchester bomber, Salman Abedi? Well, they argue national security again, only it wasn't, was it? So we're going to hear now from a former Army and Special Branch officer, Charles Shoebridge. But Martin, MI6 had this policy abroad very much, very clearly, engaging jihadis to fight in places like Syria and Libya. MI5, what was their role? Because their role was to protect the British public from people like this. They've completely failed.
Well, I think there's a quite a degree of overlap between what MI5 and MI6 do. We have got a very strong jihadi infrastructure in Britain because Operation Cyclone, the setting up of the Islamic International Brigade to fight in Afghanistan, was led by MI6 from Britain, which is why all of these people ended up here.
One of the most important things, I think, is whether we're getting proper scrutiny of MI5 from the press. And I asked Charles Shoebridge, a former army officer and former special branch officer, about that yesterday.
How close are MI5 to the media? Because they don't actually even have an official press office.
They like to suggest, of course, that they don't have a press office, and they're right, I suspect, in that. But then, of course, someone like me would say, well, you don't really need one when just about every mainstream home affairs or security correspondent acts as a press officer for you. You'll find it's very rare that you'll find criticism of MI5 in the media. In fact, it's quite interesting for me to see over the last weekend where you had a very rare occasion where MI6 is being criticised by Peter Oban, a very distinguished journalist that I've got a lot of time for. But throughout the whole article, there's another narrative running, which is that how excellent MI5 are and that MI6 have somehow dropped MI5 into trouble by facilitating jihadists aboard. There are two problems with that argument. The first is that up till at least 2013, and I've tracked this quite in some detail, up to at least 2013, MI5 was complicit in the movement of jihadists to places such as Libya, Syria. And we can know that because you've got a situation where, even though it's been unlawful in the United Kingdom since 2006 to take part in terrorist activities or fighting activities overseas, until around 2013, despite the fact that in 2011, 2012 and 2013 you had many British people going overseas to Libya and Syria to fight against Gaddafi and Assad, nothing was done to stop those people from going there. And the legislation was there, if it's, and indeed is now, used to stop people. And the reason for that, in my mind, and I said so at the time, and it seems to have been borne out, was that because those people going to places like Libya and Syria were actually on the same side as British government policy. They were going there to fight against Assad and Gaddafi to destabilize those countries. And as we know, the destabilization of Syria is absolutely key to the geostrategic plans of countries such as Saudi Arabia and Israel in particular, because, of course, Syria is an ally of Iran, which is the enemy of those two countries I've just mentioned. And so you can see how it fits into the geostrategic plans. And that's why I'm always keen to say, well, when I'm actually pointing out that MI6 has facilitated, without any doubt in my mind, the movement of jihadists, for example, from the UK to Libya and then from Libya to Syria, just as happened in the past, for example, with Afghanistan in the Soviet years, with Bosnia, with Chechnya, the movement of British jihadists to these places to fight. They think they're fighting jihad, but actually they're fighting as well for what is perceived by the British establishment to be British geostrategic interests. And so people think I'm criticising MI6 when I say that. I'm not. And in a way, it's a backhanded compliment. It's singing their praises that they are an extremely effective body in orchestrating the destabilisation and, in some cases, even the downfall of what British government policy says are enemy regimes or enemy governments.
Of course, MI5 aren't able to deal with the blowback, Martin.
Well, I mean, the idea that they're incompetent is obviously the sort of thing that the mainstream media might start to suggest, like the Daily Mail and so on.
Yeah, but Peter Oball has been saying they're doing a fine job, MI5. It looks as if they have fallen flat on their face here.
Well, I would tend to agree. In actual fact, we don't really know what kind of a job these organisations do because we're not allowed to know what they get up to.
Well, also, of course, we've got the family of the shot policewoman Yvonne Fletcher, who've been denied justice after evidence was blocked on national security grounds. Now, this isn't an old story from 1984. That is the 16th of May this year, 2017, in the Daily Telegraph. The prime suspect of the killing of WPC Yvonne Fletcher will not be prosecuted after police were blocked from using key evidence on national security grounds, it's emerged. Now, along with Lockerbie, the whole murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher was used to cook up a case against Gaddafi and against Libya, Martin, wasn't
well,
it?
Well, you will know that there was a very good dispatches programme analysing this murder.
It's called Murder in St James.
Murder in St James.
It was a two-part dispatches.
Yeah. Indeed, and the conclusion was that, in fact, she was shot not by people from the Libyan People's Bureau, but from somebody who was based in an observation point which was being manned by MI5. And the SAS's ballistics expert was interviewed in the film, and he said clearly, well, I can tell you now, it wasn't the Libyans who killed the police lady. She was probably shot by a sniper from a different direction entirely, all part of a process of making Libya
to
look
bad. So is it
okay
for MI5 or the CIA to shoot a British police officer and blame it on the
Libyans?
No,
it's not, but that's the sort of thing that goes on, and people shouldn't delude themselves.
Well, if
these are not good organisations run by nice people.
I'll put a link up to that on our show page. But I also spoke to Charles Shoebridge about accountability, because there seems to be absolutely no accountability for anybody that commits criminal acts who works for MI5.
The issue of accountability, of course, is key to this. So effectively, there is no accountability for the security services, MI6, MI5, or GCHQ. We've seen that again and again, where even decisions relating to the amount of or the release of information to bolster government claims, allowing us to go to war, for example, in respect of Iraq. The whole load of claims that were made, particularly by MI6, regarding weapons of mass destruction, had a catastrophic effect on bolstering Blair's rationale for taking Britain to war. And because they were exploited by the media, even turned public opinion to have a short-lived support for that war. So these are very, very serious issues, not just in terms of deaths of many hundreds, if you include British soldiers, of British people, but also, of course, hundreds of thousands, if not more, people overseas that have suffered as a result of these catastrophic failures. But, of course, in terms of MI6 and so on, in terms of what we're saying, of course, they may not even be seen as failures because they've achieved the greater aim. But in terms of MI5's stated role, which is to protect the UK from terrorism, these clearly are failures. But again and again, we've seen situations where GCHQ, for example, MI5, have admitted in the past that some of their officers have made mistakes or have, for example, accessed information, personal information, in the case of GCHQ, which they weren't allowed to. But in every case, there have been no prosecutions of officers. There have been no sackings, as far as we know. All that we hear about are people who are whistleblowers against MI5 or GCHQ or MI6 who then go to prison, whereas the people who actually are making these errors don't seem to suffer as a consequence. In respect of oversight here, we've got the Intelligence and Security Committee is the only supposedly independent body, along with the Surveillance Commissioner and so on. But these people never, or it's extremely rare that they make any findings against the security services. It's almost unheard of. The response usually to MI5 failings in this way is to reward failure by increasing their budget, because the argument is made, and it's being made every day now in our newspapers, that the reason for this is because MI5 doesn't have enough money. Apparently they need enough to be able to keep everybody under surveillance all the time. That seems to be the logical outcome of the rationale they're putting forward. And as I mentioned, that isn't the basis of intelligence work. Intelligence work should be about your decision making, where you actually apply the very substantial resources they've already got. Think about the ISC, the Intelligence Security Committee. Its reports go to the Prime Minister first. It doesn't report to Parliament in the same way that other committees do. Its members are appointed by the Prime Minister rather than elected by MPs. And so it's a very limited form of oversight. And if you remember when we had the sort of spectacle of about 3 or 4 years ago of the heads of MI5, MI6 and GCHQ being grilled, as the newspapers called it, live on TV for about an hour by the Intelligence Security Committee. And it then emerged, as I predicted actually at the time, live on Twitter, that actually they had been given all the questions beforehand in advance, agreed those questions, and had, of course, had a chance to prepare and rehearse their answers, and it appeared to me rehearsed at the time. And so you've got a situation that is extremely limited oversight. And all we can hope for in terms of accountability and actually even documentation being produced and information being released is through other processes such as the inquest process and also the perhaps leaks from it, foreign intelligence services and so on. But again, increasingly there's movements towards more secrecy in courts when it comes to these kinds of issues. Mm. And so I'm afraid that when it comes to accountability, the direction of travel is probably to being even less accountable than the intelligence services are now.
That's former Special Branch and Army Officer Charles Shoebridge. Now, Martin, what Charles is saying there, that despite regular failings by MI5, desperate need for accountability if we're to save British lives, the travel is in the opposite direction.
Well, I would go further than that. I think when you're dealing with terrorist incidents like this, the police should have primacy. The reason being that we have good reason to believe that Western intelligence services, NATO intelligence services, including MI6 and MI5, are potential suspects. That may sound extreme to some listeners, but it's not. It's something that's actually got to be taken on board.
Now, Charles Shoebridge mentioned Israel there and saying that quite a lot of these policies that MI6 have been pursuing with these jihadis represent useful foreign policy decisions for countries like Saudi Arabia, Qatar and Israel.
Well, indeed. I mean, all of this stuff may be fulfilling geopolitical goals, but is it legal? And is it what our intelligence services ought to be doing if they were under democratic control?
And as I said,
and
the
answer is no.
As I said at the top of the hour, it's 50 years since the beginning of the end of the UN Charter. Would you agree that that was what the 1967 Six-Day War represents? It was with Syria, Jordan and Egypt, and there was an agreed division of Palestine between those countries. The Israelis grabbed virtually the lot, didn't they, including the West Bank, Gaza and East Jerusalem.
Well, it's the source of the
occupation. And the Golan Heights.
It's the source of the occupation, which has continued ever since, which is the, you know, the fundamental problem in the Middle East that's still not been resolved. And, you know, it's important to remember the 50 years since the Six-Day War, and also, of course, the USS Liberty incident, in which the Israeli Air Force tried to sink a US spy ship, killing 30-odd sailors, because they were doing it with planes which looks as if they were Egyptian planes. So the purpose of it was to try and provoke America into a war with Egypt. It didn't happen, but scores of American servicemen were killed, and the whole thing was just brushed under the carpet.
Martin, the Golan Heights was also taken as part of that war, which is now involved. Of course, it almost seems as if there's been a kind of continuous running sore in that part of the world ever since then, which has been developing. Now the Russians have come in. What is the future for places like the Golan Heights, where people like Rupert Murdoch and other rich people in the Western world, the sort of people that would be at Bilderberg, have got oil concessions now there?
Yeah, well, I think that's another reason why they'll want to hang on to it, because they've found oil in the Golan Heights. And of course, the Golan Heights is being used as a support area for jihadi terrorists operating in Syria.
But hang on, it's controlled by Israel.
Yes, I know, but it doesn't make any difference. The Israelis allow them to come over the border to get medical treatment, and then they filter them back into the battle. And the Israelis, just like the British and the Americans, are also flying air support for Al-Qaeda in Syria. And then we go on about, where do all these jihadis come from? Well, you created them, you armed them. The SAS in Libya trained these people from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. They went over to Libya and were trained by our people that we pay for. We trained them, and then they come back and blow us to pieces.
So where is it heading, this policy in the Middle East? Because the Russians have now put their foot down, haven't they?
Well, the Russians are trying to be calm. They're trying to negotiate rather than chuck their weight about, which is not the way it's presented in the West. The real danger here is we're going to have a tripwire, and we're going to have a major all-out confrontation with the two major blocs trading missiles, tanks, bombs, machine guns, the lot. This is the 70th anniversary, the 100th anniversary of 1917, the Battle of Verdun, the Russian Revolution. I mean, all of these things, the world economy is teetering on the brink. They'll be discussing that at Bilderberg. I mean, this could all go very wrong very quickly, couldn't it?
Okay, well, on that gloomy note, Thank you, Martin. But actually, on the positive side too, of course, we've got some real coverage. If you'll go onto our show page of the Bilderberg Conference and who are going to be our next leaders in the West here, at least who will Bilderbergers will be trying to make our new leaders, at thisweek.org.uk. But it's time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7 now. Coming up on Facebook Live, maybe, sometimes he is, sometimes he isn't, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Yusuf. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Jeff Gollop from the Conservatives, Jude English from the Greens, and Asher Craig from Labour. Also, thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, to Charlie Skelton and Luke Radowski over in Chantilly, Virginia. Our sister show Dialects here at BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This show's story links and comment page, as I said, thisweek.org.uk. You'll find me on Twitter at Tony Gosling. He's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. I'll leave you with music from 1970, the goth rockers, Black Sabbath. Do please use your vote and join us for the election results at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah.
Is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.